The 19th century westward expansion of the United States beyond the Mississippi River was a colorful time in American history, full of prospectors, cowboys, bad boys, and lawmen. Three such legendary characters were born in the span of just 6 years: Wyatt Earp in 1848, Jesse James in 1847, and Alfred Packer in 1842. Let's take a look at these notorious figures of the great frontier known as the Wild West, and see what connections they have to forensic science, past and present. Young Wyatt Earp lived in Illinois, where his father was the local constable. But after Constable Earp was caught bootlegging whiskey, the family relocated to Iowa. When the Civil War broke out, Wyatt was too young to enlist with his three older brothers, Newton, Virgil, and James. But he ran away several times to join up anyway. Each time, Wyatt's father brought him back to stay home with younger brothers Morgan and Warren. After the older Earps returned from the war, the family settled in Missouri, where Wyatt's father became constable and then justice of the peace. At that point, Wyatt, who was 21, took the constable position over in 1869. He soon married, but within a year, Wyatt's pregnant wife died from typhoid fever, and other parts of his life began to unravel. While he was still the Lamar, Missouri constable, Wyatt Earp assumed his father's legacy as an unlawful lawman. He was caught embezzling money from local schools, falsifying legal documents, and also charged with horse theft. Wyatt was taken into custody in 1871, but escaped before trial, heading back to Illinois, where his brother Virgil was a saloon keeper. Younger brother Morgan joined them there too. Wyatt lived above a brothel, serving as its bouncer and pimp. After several arrest raids on the place, he moved to a floating whorehouse and gambling boat on the Illinois River. When the boat was raided, Wyatt earned a stiff fine for being what they called an old offender. Even in those days, the legal system more harshly penalized repeat criminals. Wyatt went to Kansas then and spent time in cattle boom towns before Virgil suggested they moved to the silver mining town of Tombstone, Arizona, where Virgil was appointed Deputy U.S. Marshal. Three of their other brothers, James, Morgan, and Warren, also came to Tombstone to dabble in water rights and silver mines. Wyatt's friend, Doc Holliday, a dentist and skilled gunman he met gambling, moved to Tombstone too in 1880. Those days, Holliday didn't work as a dentist, because his patients didn't appreciate his tuberculosis coughing fits. Plus, he could make a lot more money gambling than in dentistry. In Tombstone, Wyatt and another man were both vying to be sheriff and also involved in a love triangle with the same woman. Wyatt got the girl, but the other guy made sheriff. You can imagine the trouble this caused Wyatt when faced with the local law. Something that happened often since he and hot-headed Doc Holliday were fond of barroom brawls with cowboys. In those days, the term cowboy was used for Western outlaws and troublemakers who would come into town after cattle drives with money in hand for gambling, prostitutes, and whiskey. Only the ruffians were called cowboys. Legitimate cowmen were known as cattle herders and ranchers. Among the most notorious Tombstone cowboys were two sets of brothers, Frank and Tom McClory and Ike and Billy Clanton. The four were well known for stagecoach robberies and horse theft and had threatened the Earp brothers several times after Virgil's attempts to bring them to justice. In September of 1881, friends of the McClorys, Pete Spence and Frank Stillwell, robbed a nearby stagecoach. The driver reported one of the masked gunmen used the phrase, "Give me the sugar," a figure of speech Stillwell was known to use during holdups. Virgil and Wyatt Earp went out with the sheriff's posse to track those bandits. Now, you may not think of the Wild West as a place where much went on in the way of forensics, but while examining the scene, Wyatt noticed an odd-shaped boot print. And just as investigators might do today, comparing footwear evidence and manufacturer's data, Wyatt consulted the local cobbler. When he described the unusual print, the shoemaker handed Wyatt a matching heel he had recently taken off a boot he repaired. He had fixed the boot for none other than Frank Stillwell. armed with only the boot print match and the linguistic evidence of using sugar to mean money, Stillwell was arrested, as was his buddy Spence. Can you imagine that meager amount of evidence leading to an arrest today, especially based on a description of a boot print recorded only in memory? Minimal evidence wasn't what caused the judge to drop the charges, though. Stillwell and Spence had arranged alibis, which couldn't be easily refuted since no one had really seen the faces of the masked bandits. While Virgil and Wyatt Earp were in Tucson for the hearing, Stillwell's good friend, one of the McClory brothers, confronted Deputy U.S. Marshal Morgan Earp, who was left behind in Tombstone to mind the store. McClory told Morgan he would kill the Earp brothers if they ever tried to arrest any of their gang again. These events seemed to be among the last straws leading up to the infamous gunfight at the OK Corral. Just as we often see in today's gang-related shootings, alcohol and guns do not mix. One night at the Occidental Saloon, one of the Clanton brothers, Ike, got in a drunken argument with Doc Holliday. He vowed that in the morning, he and his brother and the McClory boys would settle their scores with Doc and the Earp brothers. Now, Tombstone had an ordinance against carrying guns. Cowboys were supposed to deposit their weapons at a corral or saloon at the city limits, something they never show in old westerns. But many of them carried concealed handguns, just as outlaws do today. The next day, October 26, 1881, the Clanton and McClory brothers were seen near the OK Corral brandishing guns. Now, Virgil and Morgan were permitted to carry since they were lawmen. But Virgil quickly deputized Wyatt and Doc, giving sharpshooter Holliday a short-barreled shotgun to hide under his coat, in addition to the revolvers each man carried. That afternoon, when the group found the cowboys, Virgil told them to turn over their weapons, and that's when the shooting began. The legendary gunfight lasted only about 30 seconds, with only about 30 bullets fired. Billy Clanton and both McClory brothers were killed, and Ike Clanton and a companion got away. Virgil, Morgan, and Holliday were all injured, but Wyatt Earp was unharmed. A legal hearing was held to look into the incident, and according to the cowboys, the Earps fired first. The coroner said a shotgun had killed Frank McClory, but the others died from handguns. The sheriff, the same guy whose girlfriend Wyatt stole, served as a witness for the prosecution. A far more impartial eyewitness, a railroad man who had come into town the night before the gunfight, testified for the defense, claiming he heard cowboys near the corral on the day of the battle talking about killing Virgil Earp on sight. Curious, the man asked one of the townspeople who this Virgil Earp guy was, and the person pointed out the U.S. Marshal. The eyewitness further stated he saw the man he heard talking about killing Virgil at the funeral for the dead cowboys. He pointed that man out as Ike Clanton. When in analyzing the historical accounts, many say the testimony of the sheriff and cowboys just isn't credible. Holliday would have to have been switching between his revolver and shotgun faster than humanly possible if their stories were true. But there's really no way to know who shot first. Just imagine, though, how different this incident might have been if it happened now, especially with today's automatic weapons. A group of men could fire many more shots than just 30 in 30 seconds without changing clips, let alone guns. And in a modern gunfight, any ammunition collected from surgery, autopsy, or the scene could be compared to the bullets test fired from the barrels of any confiscated guns to show who shot who. That type of gun-related science wasn't discovered until the late 1880s, when a French forensic professor connected ammunition to guns using lands and grooves. Those are the hills and valleys produced on bullets by their journey down the length of a gun barrel. Had this gunfight happened today, detailed autopsy methods could help show the direction of bullets fired, which could also be compared to eyewitness accounts. And if the OK Corral was a place where horses were parked as cars are today, there might have been surveillance cameras to capture the whole thing. Ultimately, the judge ruled not to bring the Earp brothers and Holliday to trial due to insufficient evidence, but the gunfight wasn't over. Virgil was ambushed and shot in December of 1881, resulting in the loss of the use of his right arm. Ike Clanton's hat was found at the scene, which, while compelling, was circumstantial evidence. Morgan died in March of 1882 after being shot through a window while he was shooting pool. And although the killer escaped, witnesses said they saw Frank Stillwell running away from the scene. At a preliminary hearing, Pete Spence's wife said she heard the cowboys bragging about killing Morgan, but her testimony was ruled inadmissible because it was hearsay, and by law, she couldn't testify against her husband. Wyatt vowed to kill the remaining cowboys involved. And of course, Frank Stillwell and Ike Clanton had more Earp brothers they wanted dead. So before Virgil was to accompany Morgan's body on a train to California for burial, he deputized his brothers Wyatt and Warren, as well as Doc Holliday and a few others. This was to ensure the train's safe passage and to apprehend anyone who interfered. There were rumors Frank Stillwell and Ike Clanton were planning an attack in Tucson, but by the time the train got there, Stillwell had already been shot dead. The Justice of the Peace issued warrants for Wyatt Earp and his posse, but they fled into the mountains. They later claimed to have hunted down and killed over a dozen outlaw cowboys suspected in Morgan's death or Virgil's injury. Wyatt Earp's amazing life lasted a full 80 years. He was involved in mining, real estate, racehorses, and was a saloon owner in the Alaskan territories during the Klondike Gold Rush. But his brushes with forensics on both sides of the law were not yet over. In 1901, Earp moved to California and was hired by the Los Angeles Police Department at the age of 62 to help take care of things they considered, well, let's just say outside the law. But in 1911, his shady dealings got Earp arrested yet again by the very LAPD for which he worked. Now, let's dig again into the Wild West forensic files to talk about Jesse James, but for different reasons than just his crimes. Let's look at how outlaws can grow so notorious over time, even popular, that their deeds become larger than their lives, and maybe even larger than their deaths. Jesse James was born in 1847 in Clay County, Missouri, a place they called Little Dixie due to its high number of Confederate sympathizers. Although Jesse was never in the Army, he began his lawless days along with his older brother Frank, engaged in guerrilla warfare against Union troops and their supporters in their border state of Missouri. Anti-slavery unionists ran many of the banks in Clay County. So as the local clashes heated up, some of the secessionists, including the James brothers, began robbing banks to show their contempt. During one robbery in 1869, Jesse deliberately shot and killed a clerk, not because the man resisted, but because Jesse thought he recognized him from his earlier Civil War skirmishes. The James brothers were brash. They staged Liberty, Missouri's first ever bank robbery in broad daylight and became prominently and publicly known as part of an outlaw gang. The James gang joined forces with the four younger brothers, fellow Confederate sympathizers. And in 1872, in a particularly brazen attack, the group robbed the ticket office of the Kansas City Exposition in front of over 10,000 people, firing a shot that wounded a young girl. They got less than $1,000, though if they had been there half an hour earlier, they would have gotten away with the $12,000 that had already been taken away for safekeeping. Newspaper reports said that the outlaws actually put on antics for the public during the incident and amazingly escaped the large police presence that was there. Despite the injury to the child, a cult status started to grow around the James gang. In fact, Jesse James' friend edited the Kansas City Times, and accounts in that newspaper made the James brothers look more like Robin Hood heroes than dangerous and despicable men. As the gang grew in size, their crimes became more notorious, holding up banks, but now stagecoaches and trains. So the Pinkerton Detective Agency, which dates all the way back to 1850, by the way, was hired by a couple of freight companies to find and apprehend the outlaws. Suspecting the James brothers were hiding at their mother's place, Pinkerton firebombed her house. Although a younger half-brother was killed in the incident and their mother lost her arm, that James' gang rode on. In most of the robberies, the outlaws consisted of 5 to 12 men on horseback. The estimated tally of their crimes included 12 banks, 7 trains, and 4 stagecoaches. Part of the misguided heroism directed their way was because the bandits typically didn't steal from the passengers. They only took money from safes. They also never deliberately killed anyone except Jesse's vendetta mentioned earlier. Although in one robbery, a train engineer was accidentally crushed by an overturned engine. Further adding to his mystique, for all the group's holdups and antics, and even though his picture was in all the newspapers and wanted posters of the day, Jesse James was never captured. Many attributed this to his skillful horseback riding and early experience with guerrilla-style fighting during his Civil War days. He was also said to plan his crimes very carefully in advance. He was not a disorganized criminal who acted on impulse. Jesse didn't drink alcohol and discouraged his men from doing so. Ironically, he was even said to read the Bible before robberies. But even a life of crime grows old, and by 1882, Frank James decided to give up the business, as did several other gang members, especially after a few of them had been captured or killed. As the group grew smaller, the few remaining members needed to stick close together. So Jesse asked two brothers, Bob and Charlie Ford, to move in with him. But on the morning of April 3rd, 1882, as Jesse and the Ford brothers were getting ready for another robbery, Bob allegedly shot Jesse in the back of the head, and he died later that day at age 34. Now, why would the Ford brothers turn on Jesse? It's been claimed they had a deal with the Missouri governor. But when they took credit for the killing and went to collect their reward, they were charged with murder, pled guilty, and were sentenced to hang all in the same day. A few hours before the execution, though, the governor pardoned them. Sure sounds like a deal to me. But legends die hard. Almost immediately, rumors started to emerge that the Ford brothers had staged Jesse's death so the outlaw could simply get away for good. But there were post-mortem photos, which you can find today on the internet, and James was positively identified by 2 prior bullet wounds and a partial amputation of his middle finger. Nevertheless, there were claims that someone else, a guy named Charlie Bigelow, who did resemble Jesse James, was actually buried in James' tomb. In 1948, a 101-year-old man named J. Frank Dalton claimed to be the living Jesse James. But his story didn't really hold up well to questioning. In fact, no serious scholars entertained any mystery surrounding the bandit's death. But need I repeat, legends die hard. In 1995, a team of researchers exhumed Jesse's Missouri grave, around the same time mitochondrial DNA testing first came into forensic use. They sampled 2 bones and 4 teeth and were able to get a mitochondrial DNA profile from some of the dental samples. They found 2 descendants of Jesse's sister for comparison, since mitochondrial DNA is inherited only through the maternal line, and the DNA samples from the grave matched both of those living relatives. The testing satisfied many, but because mitochondrial DNA is shared by all descendants in a maternal line, some claimed the remains could simply be some other relative of the James family. After all, many people in a county in those days could likely be blood relations. So the search for Jesse James continued. In 2000, it was decided that the remains buried in 1948 as 101-year-old J. Frank Dalton would be exhumed for testing. Why not? The man had himself buried beneath a tombstone that read, Jesse Woodson James, supposedly killed in 1882. But the forensic anthropologist involved, my good friend David Glassman, immediately knew without DNA testing that the guy exhumed wasn't Jesse. In fact, David knew the remains didn't even belong to Dalton. The exhumed man had only one arm. Somehow the headstone of the real Dalton grave had been accidentally relocated at some point. Plans were made to continue digging, but when local authorities figured out tourism would take a real hit should DNA testing prove once and for all the Dalton remains were not those of the legendary Jesse James, they decided to stop digging. In 2007, on a History Channel special, an FBI facial recognition expert compared photographs of J. Frank Dalton and Jesse James and concluded they were definitely not the same man. However, the same expert also compared antemortem photos of Jesse James to his autopsy pictures and said there were discrepancies there too. And in 2009, another anthropologist from Wichita, Kansas, my friend Pierre Morjanson, supervised the exhumation of a farmer named Jeremiah James to take DNA samples from him. This James was alleged to have died from a broken heart in 1935, but he's not Jesse. My personal forensic conclusion, while the legend lives on, the man probably did not. Okay, our last Wild West forensic tale begins in November of 1873, when 21 prospectors left Bingham Canyon, Utah, in search of gold. A couple of months later, they made it to the camp of the Ute Native Americans, where Chief Ouray urged them to spend the rest of the winter with the tribe and wait until spring to brave the mountains. But 2 weeks later, six members of the group decided to strike out on their own to beat the rest of the westward prospectors to the gold in the Colorado Mountains. Among the six was 32-year-old Alfred Packer, sometimes spelled Alfred, who agreed to guide the other five about 75 miles away to an Indian agency near Gunnison, Colorado. They took provisions for 10 days, figuring that's how long it would take them. 65 days later, in April of 1874, a lone Alfred Packer walked into the Los Pinos Indian Agency. He didn't ask for food, but rather a stiff shot of whiskey. He had pockets full of money, a rifle and skinning knife belonging to other members of his party, and he had a story to tell. Packer said the group had been snowbound for 2 months in the San Juan Mountains. After consuming their supplies, they tried to scavenge what meager resources they could find in the wilderness and were even forced to eat their own shoes. Packer said he was so weak he couldn't keep up, so the others left him behind and he found his way to the Indian agency all on his own. About a month later, when none of the other five men showed up, a party was organized to search for them. Now, this prompted Packer to spin a second version of his story. Accounts vary slightly. Some report Packer saying three of the men died along the way from a combination of exposure and starvation, while another man died in an accident. Due to the extreme conditions, the living had been forced to cannibalize the dead. Other reports of Packer's second version say the oldest man died first, the others took some of his flesh with them and traveled onward. When a second man died, they cannibalized him too. But later, while Packer was away from camp looking for provisions, one of the two remaining men shot the other. When Packer returned to camp, he and the other survivor ate the flesh of the man who was shot. Now, the end of both of these second accounts is the same, though. Packer said he was forced to kill the other remaining man, Shannon Bell, in self-defense. Now, that might have been the end of things. But in the summer of 1874, a traveling artist for Harper's Weekly was in the area, capturing images of Western landscapes to illustrate the New York-based magazine. While at a pass near the Gunnison River, just outside of Lake City, Colorado, the artist came upon the partial remains of five men, partly skeletonized, partly mummified, sprawled across the ground. He quickly but painstakingly drew what he saw, essentially a crime scene sketch, and took his artwork into town. His image showed feet still wrapped in scraps of blanket fabric, pieces of flesh strewn around the area, limbs missing large areas of muscle, and signs of a definite struggle. One man's head was missing. There was little in the way of personal effects depicted, but it was immediately suspected these were the five missing prospectors. Based on what they saw, authorities believed the victims had been killed with an axe or a hatchet. The bodies were all in one place, though, not left here and there along the trail, as in Packer's latest version of the story. A group traveled to the scene where the coroner did an examination, but there are no surviving records of his findings. The bodies were buried on a ridge nearby in Lake City, Colorado. I've been to the spot. The authorities couldn't charge Packer with cannibalism. There was no law against that in the Colorado territories. But they did charge him with first-degree murder. Before he could be tried, though, Packer escaped from jail. Some say he was slipped a key and was on the run for nearly a decade. In 1883, near Cheyenne, Wyoming, one of the original 21 prospectors recognized Alfred Packer in a saloon, and he was rearrested. At his trial, Packer told yet a third version of what happened, blaming it all on Shannon Bell, the man Packer claimed to have killed in self-defense. In his final story, which he did maintain the rest of his life, Packer was out searching for food, and while he was gone, Bell went berserk and killed the other four with a hatchet while they slept. When Packer returned, Bell came at him with the hatchet, and he was forced to shoot Bell in the gut before taking the hatchet away and plunging it into Bell's forehead. Probably due to his ever-changing story, Packer was convicted and sentenced to hang. The town actually had to send away for design plans for a gallows since they had never made one before. But in 1876, while Packer was awaiting execution, Colorado was made a state. And as such, the statutes of the former Colorado Territory no longer applied. Packer had to be retried. After a change of venue to Gunnison, Colorado, he was convicted again, this time of 5 counts of voluntary manslaughter, and in 1886, Packer was sentenced to 40 years of hard labor. 15 years later, in 1901, largely due to a crusade led by a local newspaper, Packer got an early parole from prison. Ironically, the lawyer hired by the newspaper got into a dispute with the paper's 2 owners for money they owed him, and he shot them. The newspaper men survived and hired Packer to be their office security guard. This incredible story doesn't even end there. In 1989, a group of scientific investigators exhumed the remains of Packer's companions and examined their bones, which were pretty well preserved. 3 forensic anthropology colleagues of mine, Walt Berkby, Bruce Anderson, and Todd Fenton, were among the researchers. They found cut marks on many of the bones, and a tool mark expert concluded an axe or hatchet-type implement had made many of the injuries. Using the Harper's Weekly sketch for comparison, the anthropologist even figured out who was who in the image. Based on known ages and features, including an old Civil War injury one of the men reportedly suffered, they assigned probable names to the remains. The locations of the hatchet marks on the back and sides of the skulls suggested the men were likely struck when unaware, so maybe sleeping. Some showed defensive wounds on their arms. Cut marks around muscle attachment sites could reflect defleshing. Most of them were on the victim's back sides, probably implying the impending cannibal didn't want to look at their faces. Dozens of hack marks were found on the youngest and perhaps strongest member of the group, showing he put up a fierce struggle for his life. What about any bullet wounds? One hip bone had a hole in it. Could this have been Bell's pelvic bone shot clean through by Packer? Although it's been debated by others, the anthropology team believed it was from animal gnawing, not a gunshot. The tool mark expert agreed. So, though an interesting study, the research couldn't really corroborate or dispute Packer's final account of the events, but it did suggest murder and cannibalism by one or more of the men involved. There are plenty of versions to the Alfred Packer story. Not only his, but also differing published accounts. But one thing is clear, the Colorado cannibal, as he's sometimes called, has become a cult figure, particularly at the University of Colorado, where student protests over the food quality in 1968 led to one of the dining facilities actually being renamed the Alfred Packer Restaurant and Grill, famous for its ribs and steak tartare. T-shirts and buttons bear slogans like Alfred Packer serving his fellow man and have a friend for dinner. In 1985, Colorado citizens worked to get Packer a posthumous pardon, but the then governor refused, saying he'd be, quote, eaten alive by the public if he did. Several theatrical groups have covered the Packer story, and there's even a campy movie called Cannibal the Musical. In 2006, I was privileged to travel the country as part of a National Geographic film project visiting historians and scientists involved in the Packer investigation. So what became of Packer? After his parole, he lived just south of Denver for about 6 years, but died of stroke in 1907. His death certificate listed the cause as senility, trouble, and worry. It said after his release from prison, Packer never ate meat again.